This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 13th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is The Antiquity of Auditing. This lecture is 54 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
This morning, I would like to talk to you about the practicalities of auditing and some other things. These practicalities are a little bit off the theoretical side. The whole and entire subject of auditing has many, many ancestors, is a long and continued subject, and is an entirely different subject from what is audited. Could you see that there is a difference between having a theoretical structure and performing an action called auditing? They're entirely different. We could go back to the earliest times man became aware of being a tribal being. Now, because I am not being sarcastic about ologies and isms today, you will note that I did not say tribal animal, since man has never been a tribal animal, a tribal being. He is a very gifted sort of being, in that he has been able to help himself and help others of himself. And when he became aware of this ability, he became inclined toward continued tribal existence. This is probably the most significant discovery or the most significant activity that man has ever engaged upon. The Darwinian bacteriological school of origin has placed before us a picture of man banding together to pelt his enemies with sticks and stones, has given us a great many improbable answers to why man stays together. But if we examine the actual mentality of man, and if we examine his corporate beingness, we discover really that these suppositions of banded to fight do not hold good. Now, we are probably in the highly interesting position of being able for the first time to actually look at and know without great liability exactly what man is composed of as a thinking being. We can examine his responses. We do not have to guess. We, for instance, know a great deal more on the subject of the unconscious. And we know that the story of man's thinkingness is not a story of some savage beast lingering below the level of consciousness, ready to spring upon him and force its will upon him at any moment. Whoever thought up that theory was probably a schiz. We know that man's motives are basically good, but that he assigns to others, and then on reverse, occasionally to himself, bad motives. When I say basically good, he basically means to be a sociable character. And then this is interrupted, and he begins to dwindle and decline and fall away from being a social being. Now, you understand I'm talking about man. I'm not talking about a part of man. I'm talking about all of man. Now, let's look man over, and let's find out something else. The last thing that goes by the boards in man is his ability to help. If we could find in a sanitarium, if we could find for each patient in the sanitarium the last possible rampart of assistance for his fellows, we would find the road upward for sanity for these people. Now, just as an individual's weaknesses tend to swamp him, so do his strengths live. And the last thing to perish in a man is, of course, his greatest strength. Now, that is an interesting thing as we regard this, because it gives us an entirely new picture and a new understanding of this being called man. A brand new understanding. And that understanding itself, if thoroughly enough understood, would wipe away war. So long as man is running on the stable datum that man is a warlike animal, that he came together, banded himself together, became a tribe, simply to rebuke and conquer his enemies, we have a completely erroneous stable datum. And if a world insists on running on this stable datum, it will, of course, run itself into cycles of war. We know that man fights, but then man is engaged in a game. We also know that man is not happy fighting. Out of all the fighting that is ever done, we discover that. We discover, however, that man feels better if he wins a fight than if he loses a fight. This is an oddity, since actually he simply accumulated some more overt acts. But he does feel better if he wins than loses, and he feels much better if he doesn't fight at all. Do you see that the word fight here is used very advisedly? It does mean combat with malice. Now, that's a little bit different than a game. A game is interchange with comparisons and goals. Now, if anybody tries to liken a battle on a beachhead with a football match, he can draw between them a sufficient number of data of comparable magnitude to make the bridge. This can be done, you see. Football match, everybody running back and forth and kicking the ball around, and every once in a while some player getting angry. And then we take this activity on a beachhead. Well, it's a little bit different activity. We can draw the bridge. There is a gradient scale between these two things. It is true that man has gone down scale in order to get from the football field to the beachhead. It's not just a gradient scale, it's a gradient scale downward. And the two are related, and they are of comparable activity. But I was talking to a fellow on a beachhead once, and he didn't like it. In fact, as I was standing there, I said to myself, you know, I know better places to be. In fact, as I pressed myself to a thinness of 1 micrometer, I couldn't even think of a football field. It didn't even occur to me that there was a game in progress. Well, of course, sometimes this can become very exhilarating. Of course, when you've really decided to chuck it all anyhow, nothing to live for and so on. But it's kind of a one-sided thing. I want to call to your attention that it's not a broad tribal activity, this thing, the fight. Of course, when soldiers are attacking villages, children are present, but the children are not combatants. And in more civilized parts of the world, women are not combatants either. It gives you pause. This football field, you say, well, there are no children or women there being combatants. Well, they have a better opportunity. They can at least be spectators. But we have to assume, in view of the fact that it doesn't take in all of the tribe, but is just one small manifestation of the tribe, that the football field and the beachhead are not the main activities of man, even though they do fall together on a gradient scale. Maybe man's contest with his environment and his livingness within it for all members of the tribe is his actual environment. Because remember, this takes in everybody. So we cannot take a young man between the ages, let us say, of 16 and 30, and assign his activity as the total tribal activity. And that is what the anthropologist has tried to do to us. He's represented the activities of one age band of one member of the tribe as being the highest possible activity of all members of the tribe, and has therefore and thereby tried to describe man. And he has not succeeded, and it is not true, and man being man has not reacted well to it. What then is man's activity? What is the basic activity of man? It is a game, but it's a game which is not really the game of the football field. It is simply the game of staying alive and getting going and doing things and being social in the environment in which he finds himself. And that's his game. Of course, this is much too mild and undramatic a view to capture the imagination of short story writers, or the lack of imagination of anthropologists and ethnologists. It's much too mild a view. And yet I have lived with men of many races, colors, and creeds, many barbaric tribes, 12 different tribes of men of the most barbaric and maligned nature you ever heard of. I've never had man, unless he were in an insane state, completely insane state, offer me any harm in any part of the world. That's very interesting, isn't it? I was chalking up my mileage one time, and it was 250,000 miles before I was 21. And in all those places, I never had anyone who was sane offer me any physical harm or threat, but quite on the contrary, have received a gourd of water when well needed it from headhunters. Have received food and shelter from storms in the most unlikely places. From people whom you would believe by all the descriptions you read everywhere would be the worst possible people to associate with. So we can assume then that somebody must be telling a lie about man. If you can walk into a tribe of headhunters and you not only keep your head, but you find yourself cracking jokes over this and that, and after you've overcome your slight queasiness at your host dipping into the common pot and picking out a very choice piece of meat to hand you with his bare hand, which he's not washed for some months. And if you can overcome that hand and your suspicion that it's probably dog that you're eating, why, you've overcome about all of the upset you're going to meet. Well, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Man must also engage then upon another game about lying about the other guy. He must also engage in this game. Well, why does he do that? Actually, Axiom 36 tells us that every second postulate is a lie because it's in controversion in the same time continuum to the first postulate. You understand, first and second postulate must be in a time continuum native to each other in order for the second postulate to be a lie. But the second postulate is only a lie because it controverts the first postulate. We have assumed that this is true, now we assume something else is true. First postulate has power, the second postulate has no power. It's an oddity, but it doesn't have any power. It is the apparent thing, but the power lies behind it. And this is the hidden thing for which man has been searching, and he has called it the unconscious mind, and he's called it all sorts of things, you see. But there is something behind the apparency which has strength. And man has been looking for this strength. And in looking for this strength, he has made many mistakes because the apparency itself is apt to be a lie. Now, the first postulate and the second postulate picture becomes very comprehensible if we realize that if the first postulate is goodness, the second postulate will be badness. You see, then, that we'd have an apparency of badness which had the totality of force of goodness. It's only because we can conceive man to be good that we conceive him to be bad. But if we paint him up as bad, the only strength to his badness is the potentiality of his goodness. It's very, very interesting. that nothing happens with most people if you simply assume the first postulate. Unless the person is insane, which is to say, the second postulate has totally solidified. It's yet backed up with force and power, but assuming goodness starts to run out and explode the second postulate. And we get an explosion of badness because we've said he's good. Follow me? It is closer to the native beingness of man to be good than to be bad. Now, this is not slippery logic. It just happens to work that way. Now, wandering around and hanging up my hat on the breadfruit tree and squatting alongside of evilly smelling fires in villages where the movies would teach you a spear could be expected any moment, and never finding any such conditions existing, I may have been disappointed when I was a young man because there were so few people you could legitimately shoot. But although I may have been disappointed, I was edified. And I came to the rather outrageous conclusion, very young, that I have never since departed from. And that was that it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in, if you're sane, and which is to say sociable, there isn't anything can happen to you except just the common incidents of mess flopping around and running into mess and sometimes catching you in between. So, with a conclusion of this character, I've kept the only modification that man in an insane state is insane only because he has ceased to be social. And this is an animal. We could almost say, this is too broad a definition, but it's not a definition. We could almost say that man only becomes an animal after he goes mad. And that where we find man living in an animal condition, he has gone mad. Now, I'm putting this interesting proviso on the entire thing of saying that there's madness in here, which is kind of a poorly defined thing. Well, madness is the action of exploding into random action when being triggered by the postulate that one is good. Insanity ensues that when somebody says you're good, you go bad. Now that makes a terrifically interesting gradient scale of sanity. Someone says, you're a good runner and you won and you feel bad about it. Get the idea? Well, everybody can do that, but you certainly don't explode and blow up in people's faces. You accept the cup and grin rather embarrassedly. And you say, yes, I'm best runner. Actually, your embarrassment might simply be from the fact of being singled out as an only one by other people around you, which you don't feel is right either. But if someone comes up to you and says you're really a good man, and you instantly pick up a butcher knife and start after him to destroy, in other words, it could be said that you would be insane, you see. What has happened here? The mechanic is that the first postulate is triggered, and the second postulate explodes. One is no longer able to live on this apparency. There's something gone wrong here with the mechanics of the beast, and we have a beast. It's quite interesting that if you make a thorough enough address to the first postulate, the other runs out, at least for the moment. Can you see this mechanism of the skid, which you have been watching in people? The mechanism whereby we hit the first postulate and skid into the second postulate. Can you see this magnified to explosive proportions? Now, even a tiger can be sane. A tiger sitting there and you say, well, hiya, fella. A tiger goes, purrs. But if he's crazy tiger, you come up to him and you say, there's a good fellow, and he goes, yeah. You see, he's crazy. So even a tiger can be sane. Even a black panther could be sane in that definition. And so we do find sane tigers and sane black panthers. And so we do find that there is a gradient scale below the gradient scale of man's beingness, which has to do with this. The ability to communicate on the part of the animal, of course, is not very great. And to say that man is an animal says immediately that he can't communicate. Man is not an animal because he can communicate. He does communicate, and he only becomes an animal when he can't communicate. If tigers could talk, they would probably go mad less often. They don't talk. Last one I said hello to said, meow. Do you see, then, a great oddity occurring here, an oddity? You have a ridge of beingness and behavior, a fascinating aspect here. You have an apparent badness, and back of that is a goodness. And we touch the goodness, and we very often merely bring it to life, and it runs all right. But if the man is mad, we'll explode the badness. The only reason we don't explode all the badness on this type of postulate, the only reason we don't explode all the badness is because we don't want the explosion. And our unwillingness to handle an explosion of badness, our continuous fending off of this explosion, keeps man from running it out. And we have got him in a suspended cycle of action today, whereby the threat of punishment, the various scientific opinions of the being and character of man alike run out less and less the badness, you see. Actually, any badness that is accumulated there, any ridges that he comes up against and so on, are simply addressed. And look, this is very interesting, but that badness doesn't as is very well. Now, all the badness consists of is this. The badness consists of misadjustments with the environment. That's all. Here we have a social tribe, and two or three elements in it keep bumping into each other. There's no hate or upset involved. They simply keep bumping into each other. There's two or three clans. And their interests come in conflict. And if they're in real good shape, they will resolve this conflict, and nothing evil will result. But if their interests are not resolved, they will get into a condition where the bumps are more and more frequent and more severe. And this severity will eventually wind up into the opinion of each other that the other fellow is bad. Not one man there considers he is bad, but he considers, because of the conflict of interest, that the other fellows have bad intentions. The other fellow doesn't understand enough about the interests of the first fellow, you see, to know that their intentions are really bad toward the first fellow. And so you're always getting this phenomenon of a number of individuals who have been violently at war sitting down together and talking it over and going away happy. You're always getting this. They simply discover that the other fellow's intentions aren't bad. Here we have A and B facing each other, and they're just doing fine, you see. And A and B facing each other, and now their interests come in conflict. They're both social, sane, good, happy, effective. They can function. And their interests come in conflict. And A isn't paying any attention to B's interest, B supposes. So therefore, it must be that B believes that A is bad. But how is A bad? Only from B's viewpoint. And B and A, with this mechanism, can then each become possessed of the opinion that the other is evil. And that's all the evil there is. And this is the totality of the mechanism. Now, when A and B are so thoroughly in conflict that they collapse upon each other, these opinions of the other fellow, then A and B start to act badly, even themselves. Thus it is that although we are all noble heroes in a war, we come out and rob banks. You follow me? It's all very well to go through the war and protect your country, and by and large a fellow recognizes this as a high artificiality and he gets through it somehow. But he comes out of it with a less good opinion of himself. Well, he has been so violently thrust up against the enemy's opinion of him, and he himself has thrust up against the enemy so violently his opinion of them, that some of that collapsed on the individual. And he began to accept the other fellow's opinion of him as bad as his own. Therefore, he can say at length, I am a bad man. Whose opinion is it that he is a bad man? It was the other fellow's opinion of him. No man on the face of earth has ever had natively the idea that he himself was bad, or that his tribe was bad. You see? This is one of those horrible, sweeping things that you'd say is, well, good heavens, this just can't be to this degree. You know, this can't be. We'd have anything as one-sided as this. Certainly some thetan has come along, and sooner or later he's popped up, and his first postulate was, I'm a bad un, you better stay away from me. Never has been. First place, the time he's making such considerations, he doesn't have any opinions of goodness or badness. If he's simply good at shooting people, he's still got an opinion of goodness. All right. So nobody has ever embarked with this idea of he himself being bad. He has embarked with the idea of his own goodness. And then somebody else inferred that he was bad, and he has asserted that he was good. And that's the first postulate. He didn't accept the other fellow's postulate. He said, no, I'm a good fellow. We have then on the track in every being first postulate. And this works quite remarkably. It isn't any real reason this should work at all, you know. It might be some entirely different pattern, but this one happens to function. So this must be somewhere near the truth of the matter. That's the only reason I'm talking about. He has been convinced that he was good, and then he has thought of the other fellow as bad, and the other fellow has thought of him as bad, and sooner or later they collapsed the bad appearances on each other. And only then does an individual get the sneaking notion, you know, I'm not quite the angel I pretend. Well, let's look at ownership processing and find out that if you establish the exact ownership of any ridge or condition, it goes poof. Well, this becomes very interesting. It looks like a fellow who is convinced that he is bad, or bad off, or upset in any way, shape, or form, is running rather uniformly on somebody else's idea of him, which he has now owned as his. And so it persists. We get the persistence of this idea of badness. An individual doesn't think he's as able as he might be, or as competent. He doesn't think he is as well-intentioned as he could be. He doesn't think he is as strong or as forward or forthright as he might be. He rather thinks otherwise. And if he did think otherwise, and that thinkingness persisted, we must then assume that he wasn't thinking the thoughts he thinks he's thinking. There must be somebody else's thinkingness. They're persisting, aren't they? So just by this test of ownership, if he got the right owner, if he himself really thought these, they'd go woof, and there'd be no more thinkingness about how bad he was. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Now, conversely, he looks at other people and thinks they know they are bad and thinks they intend bad things. And they intend good things, so he has misowned that badness too, hasn't he? That's his badness. Now we get another mechanism of swapping of valences. He thinks B is bad, and then becomes B. You got the flip of valence?
Yeah.
Fantastic. But as we get the valence shift, and as we get the backup of these postulates on the individual, and as we explore this thing with a little tool called ownership processing, we don't find anywhere in it anyone's opinion of himself as bad. Nobody believes that he's bad. And so we discover it in the world at large. We have a gunman, a hood, a fellow who is sitting in a car, and a police officer simply walks by and glances in his direction. He guns the police officer down. He kills a young woman. He robs an old man in a store, shoots him dead. This fellow racking around in the society, we would say, well, at least we have one man there who knows he's bad. Oh, not so. That was Pretty Boy Floyd. And a transcript of his statements made in jail tell us that he was just a good boy trying to get along. And the phrenologists, phrenology is a subject taught in most universities. I think that's the subject. The phrenologists had a very remarkable idea about this. They said, it just proves how wrong criminals are. And this was the tremendous conclusion which they reached. They saw no further in this mechanism that here is one of the most vicious of criminals doing some of the most vicious things you can imagine. And we have this great oddity. When he sits down in the jail, he's not apologizing. He simply gives a statement about how it looks from his end. And it looks from his end that he was always well-intentioned. He was trying to get along, but things kept getting up in front of him and pushing him around, and he just had to act in some direction or another. And this was his idea, Pretty Boy Floyd's idea, of Pretty Boy Floyd. Oddly enough, it's the correct one. And if the great phrenologists, in their study of criminology and so forth, had maybe talked to an awful lot of criminals, they would have come to an interesting common denominator, which they themselves then didn't have to reinterpret. And it was this common denominator. We didn't find any place where anybody thought his intentions were bad. But we came everywhere to people who believed that they were fighting against people with bad intentions. And the criminal believes completely and implicitly that the intentions of the society at large are viciously bad. And we're going to make a social being out of him by punishing him some more? Oh, let's all go nuts. We'll just let the phrenologist go nuts, and we'll do something about it. You see then that a door opens for the rehabilitation of the criminal, the like of which you never looked at before. There is a terrifically wide-open door. You could drive a battleship through it. All you have to do is just establish for the criminal the actual intention of the society. He will cease to be a criminal at that moment, and we can save the taxpayers an awful lot of money if it's worth saving. We'll find some other way to waste money to make up for running penitentiaries. Let's look at these factors. These factors are extremely interesting. And in the field of auditing itself, we have always had an automatic factor, which has been with man since his earliest tribal days, and that is, man is capable of helping the other man. And this only disappears when he believes that the other man doesn't deserve help. Now, impossibility of communication was the subject of an earlier lecture, remember? That's the low rank, rock bottom, no further south postulate. Impossible to communicate. Well, when we say, this man no longer deserves help, we have said, impossible to communicate. And the last of the worthwhileness of livingness in man goes out when he makes that postulate uniformly in all directions and all sides. So therefore, on the same rock bottom, we say, these people do not deserve help. We have assisted the triggering in of impossible to communicate. When an individual does this, he might as well pack up his little grip and get himself a ticket to Cuckoo Lodge. Because there's where he's going. He'll either become a nut or a politician or almost anything. See? He says, this man does not deserve help. And we wonder why we have crime. This man does not deserve help. Put him up for the court, send him to jail. That's right. That's it. Well, we've dealt with that problem. I wonder why criminals are multiplying so fast. Well, we'll take care of that. They don't deserve to be helped. Put them in all front for court. Put them in jail. There they are. Well, I guess... What the devil? They've doubled again. Now, listen, these people do not deserve help. No. I mean, this nutty cycle has got to be stopped somewhere along the line. I mean, somebody's got to come along and say, hey, maybe we can at least get the criminals to help each other, huh? And that's the Scientology plan for the wiping out of crime, is to get the criminals to help each other. With the full permission of the court. Well, I'll help the criminal. It's impossible to communicate over there. But they might let these guys help each other if they're all locked up in a bin anyhow, you know. And I've been for some time getting together a little stack of notes on the exact material to be prepared. One of these days we'll have it all prepared. Actually, we could probably make it up from existing materials now. But it actually should be specifically prepared. And all we do is take this package of materials, you see, and a tape player, and the requisite number of books, and we get the okay from the warden. A fantastically easy thing to get, by the way. You know, the chief warden of all federal pens in the United States has already issued directions that every warden there should read Dianetics. Now, I have had two or three appointments with him, which I couldn't keep, mostly because the guy wanted me to take over a penitentiary, lock, stock, and barrel. When we're ready, we fire, see? There's no sense standing around on the firing line till you got a little ammunition. With a package of training and processing materials to be studied, and with some lecture tapes and examples of auditing and auditors doing auditing and so on, and examples of group auditing, some group auditing tapes, we just move this whole business inside the walls of the penitentiary. And we let them help each other to this degree. We get the warden to let them out when he is satisfied with their psychometric results and recommend them for pardon and take care of them and give them a good time of the whole thing if they clear a couple of other guys. Get the idea? When we make this condition, the additional condition to release. In view of the fact that wardens and parole boards have more say than you think about the release of criminals, the least they could do is simply start releasing them on minimum sentence if they did so and so. You see, they do have a way to do that. Your criminal will go out into society and your criminal population will drop. It'll drop for various reasons. But it won't drop appreciably unless we also include in our materials a rearrangement of the intentions of the society. The criminal considers himself a white knight and a hero who is riding against this ugly, horrible, rotten thing called society. Wow, what another look. And even a criminologist, one who has examined the most hard-bitten cases listening to me today, I'm sure would do a couple of cognitions unless he himself had gone mad. You know, he'd say, well, come to think about it, I just never did meet a criminal who was convinced he was a bad man. Never did meet a criminal who didn't suppose that society was rotten and evil and therefore ought to be knocked flat. wait a minute, this does hold water. Let's see that if we can't maybe explore this a little bit further. And if he looked over auditing and its results and the principle that if you communicate into anything, you'll disinterbulate it. If you establish communication line between two things, they have a tendency to get some space between them and get some understanding between them. And he would see that we actually do have, at this instant, the solution to crime in the civilized nations of Earth. That's not an inconsiderable solution to have on your hands, is it? Well, we've got so many that we're solution happy, you know. There's too darn many solutions now. Well, let's look at this thing called auditing. Now, I've just given you a long rundown on criminology, and it has a lot to do with this thing called auditing. Do you know that man has never been without, in his entire history, beginning, of course, with a semi-organized tribe until the present, without an activity somewhat like this activity called auditing? He's never been without this. On a corvette, the commanding officer is also the medical doctor. That's because they don't have medicos enough to go around, and 100-some-odd men, of course, a small number of men, and getting shot at the most often, and so you don't need much medical care there. But nevertheless, there is a medical doctor provided for on this corvette. Isn't that an oddity? They just don't really provide for it. They give him a pharmacist mate who might or might not know something, and they just say the commanding officer of the corvette is the medical doctor of the ship. And here's a great oddity. You don't find many commanding officers who won't act as one. This is an oddity. Because the commanding officer of a corvette ought to be this way, and he ought to be that way, and he ought to do this and that, and he's probably not very interested in his fellows, and he's interested in keeping up that beautiful isolation of command and all that sort of thing. But these guys, without any knowledge at all, will talk to the men about their ills and aches and pains when the going gets rough. Maybe he will be a little bit savage and impatient, being tired, when somebody won't simply get well because he told him to. Maybe he gets a little upset with this, but what he's getting upset with is this mechanism. I want to call this to your attention. The individual was offered help, and rage comes only when the help either is refused or is ineffective. Then we start getting mad at them. We say they have evil intentions. Our intentions, they get well, they don't get well, therefore their intentions are evil. And therefore, they have these evil intentions just to upset me. Because certainly I know that I, as a Thetan, should be able simply to go, and the guy's well. And what's he standing there in the bridge for? With a shot hole in him. I mean, he ought to be all healed up. Oh, come on, fella, let's... oh, my. Unappreciative devils, I mean... But even if he got kind of sore about it or upset, I've seen, you know, one of the nastiest things to handle is venereal disease. Yeah. You're in port a few days, men hit the beach, come back aboard, you sail. There's no medical officer. It takes 3 days for the earliest and mildest of these things to set in. It takes some weeks for the more violent versions to set in. You've got men living cheek by jowl. And illnesses of this character can cause blindness and everything else. And you just haven't, you can't run a chance of anything occurring because your crew might start going by the boards and there goes the efficiency of the ship, although this isn't the practicality that points up all this. You have to do something about it. Now, I've never seen a CO on a corvette or a patrol craft running into this problem who didn't try to do something about it. This is an oddity. This is one of the nastiest problems that a guy has ever faced with. It is so much an invasion of privacy, is so shockingly intimate, has so much to do with the mores and so forth of the society at large, that treat a bunch of sailors who have gotten themselves beautifully smeared. Something that you just don't enjoy, that's all. Usually then a commanding officer could be expected to say,
Well, pharmacist means you do something. Now, keep him out of here, you know? You do something about it. To hell with the whole problem. They don't do that. You know, unfortunately, they get mad at him very often. And they say, Jones, for good sakes, you realize that this is going down as misconduct in your service record. You realize you're going to be denied every day's pay or off duty until you get well. You realize I'm going to clobber you. Now, what's the matter with you? What can we do about this? Sulfanilamide, sulfasalazine, penicillin. We've got weapons these days. We'll do something about this. Fills the guy full of sulfanilamide. Maybe that's all he had. And the guy's standing there on watch because the ship's shorthand, and he's standing there. Skipper's over in the Dodger, the bridge, you know, and he sees Jones standing over there. And Jones is going, zarm. And he goes over and he says, go below. Somebody relieve this man. And he'd be down through the sick bay a little while later, and he'd look at Jones lying there in the bunk, and he'd say, now what's the matter with you? I just feel dizzy. I just feel upset. You know, I just feel dizzy. Well, what the hell can we do about you now? It's fantastic, see? This skipper has never had any medical training. He has no goals or ambitions of any kind to be a medical doctor. And yet, on the very line that he should keep very nice and separate, you see, his relationship to himself as a crew, he'll close terminals on helping individual members of that crew. A captain is insane who will not help his crew. Is insane. I say that advisedly because I have shipped with and know insane captains. They're insane. One captain got himself so beautifully upset on the score of people, had himself so misaligned about the intentions of the crew, that on a mutter that ran through the crew, because he himself had made, unfortunately, a remark through an open speaker system, his telephone talker with an open speaker microphone, you see, that went through all the ship's speakers, was standing right alongside of him, and the captain was informed, the boat groups won't be able to get away for another half an hour, sir. The ranges broke down, and they won't be able to get any food for about 30 minutes. What do I care whether or not the sons of bitches eat? Get them into those goddamn boats. Oh, no. The speaker was open. I won't say that his telephone talker had it open on purpose. But this was the normal regard of this man for his crew. There was a mutter went around about this. Men were sent out which were going to be out until 6 o'clock that night with nothing in their stomachs at all. And he sent them out. And there was a mutter about this. And he instantly and immediately chained off both of the bridges which went past his cabin. Here was the big navigation bridge, and above that the signal bridge. Below that was the captain's bridge, and then there was the main deck of the ship. In order to get to the navigation bridge, and there's a terrific amount of traffic going on to the bridge of a ship, you either had to go up past the captain's cabin, or you had to climb up a ladder back of the stack, a very thin steel ladder, and climb over a railing and drop onto the navigation bridge. And this guy chained off and made ingress impossible to the navigation bridge by blocking off the entire section of his quarters. You get the two actions and how they are of the same order of magnitude. These two actions are of the same order of magnitude. To hell with them, damn them, want nothing to do with them, and blocking off the bridge so that they can't kill him. That was his statement on the matter. So another officer myself simply went to work on him, put him totally out of action. We told him how put upon he was. We finally practically put him down in his bunk. We didn't have him walking around the ship anymore because he was tearing the ship to pieces. But this man was insane. This man was an alcoholic. This man himself had been orating. This man believed that his fellow man had the worst possible intentions in all directions. And this man couldn't track, as a rational man does, on common, ordinary subjects. You or I would have watched this man walk in. We said, that man's crazy. See? We said, bang, he's crazy. And it's that level of insanity which reacts that way, and it's reacting that way simply because there's no communication one way or the other. Now, I would say this man somewhere in the back track tried to help too often and failed. You got it? He tried to help too often and failed, maybe while down in the forecastle, maybe been beaten up often, all kinds of things might have happened to him, but we finally get him shot to the top of the barrel in charge of better than 500 men. And in this kind of a frame of mind about men, and we find a non-functioning tribe. Which is my total point. Tribe doesn't function anymore. There's no mutual assistance possible. Nobody could help him. He couldn't help anybody. And we didn't have a tribe. You can read all you want about Captain Bligh. I can tell you Captain Bligh couldn't have had a tribe. Where man has not had an activity similar to auditing, the care of one person or more by another, an interest on the part of an individual in discovering the troubles and communicating with them amongst his fellows, where this activity has not existed, no tribe has existed. And therefore we find that to be the oldest activity of mankind. And certainly the one that he is most closely dedicated to. Where man no longer acts to audit, where he insists on staying out of communication and using surgical instruments, staying out of communication using pills, he is dramatizing and expressing an apathy, and the public doesn't want too much to do with him. Therefore, maybe we find the fields of healing going by the boards to the degree that they depart from auditing, because auditing has always been here. The counseling practitioner, the witch doctor who advises, the shaman who looks into these problems and troubles and asks the fellows how they are and so forth. You see? And a field of healing cannot function or operate below that level. Auditing is the oldest activity man has and is therefore to a large degree misunderstood. And we, a handful of us today in this time and age, are probably the first group to understand a great deal about this mechanism called auditing. We really aren't doing, however, anything very new. We just know how to do it an awful lot better. Thank you.